Genesis chapter, I got my glasses out. Try that again. Genesis chapter 1, we got to verse 5 last week, and we'll maybe get to verse, 13 tonight. Real quickly, we are going over God's days of creation. Day 1 was last week, that's Sunday if you will, and that was light, but not this kind of light that we're sort of familiar with. We're not going to see the stars or combustive light for a couple more days yet. I think the first light that appeared in God's creation was his Shekinah glory. And then we sort of winked as we remembered that it's that light, his Shekinah, that's going to be the primary source of light there in the New Jerusalem. No sun. Day 2, the firmament. We're going to look at that today. And I think more precisely, matter and linear time. Day 3, we'll look at starting next week. That's Tuesday. That's plant life. Day 4 is the sun, stars, planets, and moons. Day 5, Thursday, is fish, fowl, and great sea creatures. And we had some fun with that a couple weeks ago on Sunday, checking out dinosaurs that are noticed and lived nearby to humans. That's Job chapter 41 and 42. Day 6 is going to be that Friday, but that's when animals and Adam and Eve were formed. And then day 7 was a rest. And that's not because God is tired, because he doesn't lose power when he uses power. It was a pattern for us. You work 6, you rest the 7th. All right, chapter 1, we are in verse number 6. We are in day number 2, the firmament. And most of you, as you have cruised through your Bible, most people say, well, that's the land, and it could be. But let's sort of keep an engineering sort of perspective open and see what may be possible. Verse 6. And God said, let there be a firmament in the midst of the waters. Waters in the midst? What do you mean? And let it divide the waters from the waters. Now, this is not horizontal. This is not the continents. Watch what happens here about these waters. Verse 7. And God made the firmament, and that Hebrew word is rock-iah, and it means extended surface. Could be land, could be terra firma, but let's keep reading. And divided the waters which were under the firmament from the waters which are above the firmament. And it was so. I saw an article one time when a Stanford University engineer took to task the ridiculous notion of the entire planet Earth being flooded above Mount Everest by 40 days and 40 nights of rain. Now, he was a smart guy. He was an engineer and a professor there at Stanford. He did some calculation, and he took the highest point on the planet, which is today Mount Everest, 30-plus thousand feet. He then mathematically sort of formulated or imagined a water overtopping that great height. And then he figured with that volume of water, how long it would take for rain in 40 days. So he figured out that the rain would be falling so hard that would actually, with friction, it would ignite into flame in the atmosphere, like a falling comet. So he's aha, Christians are so stupid. And very often it's because people don't read their Bible in depth. And here's an important informational fact. Planet Earth was not like it was then, is not like what it is today. There was no Everest. And some people say, well, then where did the water go if the whole earth was flooded? Where could it drain to? And the Psalms tell us when God was ready, he lowered the ocean basins to their current depths and raised up or averaged the land above the oceans. And so the shorelines of the continents were averaged out to roughly what they are today. I also believe, and Christian might get a kick out of this, I believe that I'm going to show you when we get to chapter 6, geological evidence that Pangaea was probably a real thing. That at one time, the entire continent was one continent on the earth. And then when it was time for Noah's flood, that God cracked open what are today the current plates that make the North and South America plate, the India plate, which is diving under the whatever plate that it's next to, that's what's pushing up the Himalayas, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I believe also that when that happened, it cracked open. Remember this water that was under the firmament? Well, that came gushing out. And the water that was above the firmament was suspended in the atmosphere in some place. Was it droplets? Was it ice crystals? I don't know. But suddenly, all of that condensed at a very high rate, and water pouring down from above and spewing out from underneath, that's what flooded the earth. And when God was ready, he lowered the current ocean basins, raised the current continents, and that's what we're basically seeing now. Now, by the way, we are seeing that North and South America are creeping away from Africa and Europe. And it's the rabbit pace of, I don't know, a couple inches a year. And so we know that the plates are moving. And my supposition that we'll get to in chapter 6 is that when those plates cracked, they cracked suddenly and moved hundreds of miles potentially per hour for a short period of time. And all of that water gushing out from underneath and condensing from up above flooded the earth to a significant depth. And then when these cracks were happening, can you imagine the earthquakes, which of course would result in massive tsunamis? And I'm going to show you that archaeologists in the last couple of years have been drilling core samples in North and South America, and they have discovered that North America specifically was overtopped from the West Coast and the East Coast, and it laid down hundreds of feet of sediments. And what do you think happened to the poor little dinosaurs? So the current theory is that a great big comet hit right between North and South America, right around the Yucatan Peninsula in Mexico, near the Gulf of Mexico. And then that's what tossed up so much into the air, and volcanic winter resulted, and that's what killed the dinosaurs. But wouldn't you suppose then the dinosaurs, where they died, they would, if there was a great particulate in the atmosphere and they died, remember, most bones on the surface don't survive very long. They will break down because of bacteria, UV radiation, what have you. Think with me. What if there were six huge overtoppings of monstrous tidal waves from the West Coast and the East Coast, and they found that there is a finger of land running right up, basically into Montana and South Dakota. And it would seem that many dinosaurs use a bit of a land bridge, some of the last terra firma before the sixth and final deluge, basically washed them all together and then piled them up in massive graveyards, covered them quickly because of volcanic minerals as well as the water and sediments, and covered them suddenly. And that's why in, is it not Hell's Kitchen? It's Hell's something in Montana. Did you know that North America is the Saudi Arabia of fossils and dinosaur bones? And I'm going to show you that that was probably a result of this great big flood. Well, back to our study here. Where did the flood come from? Not from the rain. The rain was a result of all of that ocean of atmosphere above our heads that used to diffuse direct sunlight into a sort of even heating of the entire surface. It's conceivable that the poles were not nearly as cold as they are today, nor were the equator inordinately hot. And it is the hot and cold, high pressure, low pressure, and remember, high pressure always transfers to lower pressure. That's when the winds started. And one of the things that Noah noticed was wind. And for the first time, he saw a rainbow. We're going to see in the next couple of weeks that Garden of Eden was not watered by rain so much that condensed out of the sky. It was watered from a moisture mist that would come from underneath. And here it is. One more time, verse 7. God made the firmament, rakia, extended surface, and divided the waters which were under the firmament from the waters that were above the firmament. Also, we said, too, if you've got all that water suspended in the atmosphere, it would weigh the atmosphere, would weigh more than it does now. You've heard me say before, you take 1 inch a column of air at sea level, and if you could keep it steady and all the way out, 1 inch all the way up to where there is no atmosphere, it's 14.7 pounds. That's why suction cups work. You squish them against the glass, the air underneath is not there. Why can't you pull it off? It's because you have 14.7 pounds times the circumference of that suction cup, and that's why you can't pull it away. You are trying to lift. Well, do the math on that. It could be several hundred pounds. That's why it works. Now, if there was water added on top of that column of air, do you see that the air pressure would be increased significantly? So what I'm saying is, before the flood, while that water canopy was in the air, diffusing ultraviolet radiation and cosmic radiation coming in from space, it is that radiation that messes with your DNA trying to replicate itself. And it is assumed by many that aging is a process where your DNA can't replicate as cleanly as it used to when you were little. And a big component are radiation bombardments coming in from outer space and mostly the sun. When the atmosphere had that full canopy of water suspended upon it and in it, also people lived for almost 1,000 years. So that all makes perfect and logical sense to me. Now the oceans below, same thing. I believe that there was a Pangaea. I'm going to show you that these overtoppings and rock layers are the same in North America as they are in Europe. You go to, in some cases, the cliffs of Dover or some of these other places, and you find these strata of rock. You compare them to a similar strata of rock in North America, meaning at one time, very likely, they were connected. Well, we'll have fun when we get there in Genesis chapter 6. Now, verse 8. And God called the firmament heaven. So the idea of heaven, well, isn't that sort of in the air, in the atmosphere? It could be. But I want you to notice that really, this could be a flat section of ground, terra firma, this firmament. Or, in my opinion, better described, it is matter. Matter and linear time. And a portion of it was called heaven. And the evening and the morning were the second day. Remember from last week, evening is erev, and it means mixture or cloudy or muddy. And morning is boker, and that means becoming more discernible. Why did God start his day, as it were, at evening, and then you go from darkness to light? Because it's a model. When we get a hold of the Lord at first glance, we don't know a lot of stuff. We are seeing through a glass dimly or darkly. And the model is hang close to the Lord, and then your day will go from darkness, it'll go from a mixture, erev, muddy, and it's going to go to bokur, morning, and that is becoming discernible, coming to truth. It's kind of an object lesson every single day. So that was the second day. I wrote my margin here, all matter exists in states of firmness. Well, what do you mean? Well, everything that we know is either a solid, liquid, or a gas. Well, gas isn't very solid, but at the molecular level, it could be. The point of it is God slowed down his more than light speed and strength energy, slowed it down into the form of what we know as molecules. So in a sense, there's a kind of a solidness, as that might be what is referenced. And then now scientists, physicists are saying, there's another sort of state of matter, and that is called plasma. If you're a Star Trek fan, you know all about that. Plasma drives, you know how that works, and so on. Well, it could be, roughly restated, plasma is the subatomic world of quantum mechanics, photons, gravitons, and all that kind of stuff. At the plasma level, say these physicists, all electrons are stripped from their nucleus, yet they behave as if they know each other, said Dr. David Bohm, University of London. And there must be then, therefore, a kind of a fabric, so to speak, or a lattice. And of course, that's where Peter Higgs came up with his Higgs boson, the God particle that tried to explain this. So at plasma levels, subatomic particles behave in a very un-Newtonian way. Newton's laws are still in effect. A body will stay in motion unless acted upon by some other body in motion, etc., etc. Gravity, when the apple fell on his noggin, so to speak. It's a quaint story, but it illustrates the point. But at the quantum level, smaller than electrons, matter behaves quite differently. In quantum mechanics, now I don't know that I really understand this, but I'll read it to you. In quantum mechanics, every particle has an antiparticle. That has to do with things called spin, negative and positive charges, and then you've heard like the USS Enterprise is flying through space because it uses antimatter and matter, because when they see each other, because they are exactly opposite, they move from their solid forms of these structures like quanta, and they annihilate one another, giving off all of their energy. So the theory is, if you have an antimatter piece, keep it in a vacuum. Don't let it touch any of the other matter. But then if you want to, boo-ha-ha, you open the lid, you toss it here into our sanctuary, and all of a sudden it annihilates all of the matter around it, releasing all of that matter's energy. And of course, then the singularity or the black hole would begin right here in our sanctuary. And we don't want that to happen. So if you get some antimatter, please don't bring it to church, just saying. Every particle has an antiparticle. Particles plus their antiparticles equals annihilation and the release of all of that energy. Because remember, energy is equal to mass times the acceleration of the constant of the speed of light squared. So whatever mass you have, imagine that gets all the way suddenly converted to energy. That's where the atomic bomb comes in, because they're just cracking small portions. A few grams of uranium-238 and so on, or is it 235, they're converting to energy. That's why it's so powerful. One way, because the equation is equal, it is theoretically possible to reverse the equation. What do you mean? Well, photons, light, reverse the process. Wouldn't that then therefore result in all quantum particles? Let there be light was the first day of creation. And is that your Bible that far ahead of the physicists? Interesting idea. Don't know. From quantum particles, of course, then comes all of the matter that we know about now. Now back to this plasma state. This plasma state might be that which was separated and called firmament. That is Steve reaching way beyond the scripture, but it's an interesting thought nonetheless. A continual solid surface would fit this model. And with that in mind, I got a couple of my aunts and uncles. Go ahead, let me show my uncle, Uncle Bohr. This is Uncle Niels Bohr, born in 1885, died in 1962. He was from Copenhagen, Denmark. He won the 1922 Nobel Prize for atomic structure and radiation. He is a huge thinker and really put into place some of the building blocks of sub-subatomic settings and situations. Some of his mathematics, of course, would result in the atom bomb, along with Einstein and some of these others. He said this. He's talking about quantum mechanics and such. Anyone who is not shocked by the quantum theory just doesn't understand it. I think that's interesting. Yeah. Physicist humor. Go ahead to the next guy. Here's Uncle Richard Feynman. He's an American physicist. 1965 Nobel Prize for quantum electrodynamics. Look what he says. I think it's safe to say that no one understands quantum mechanics. They're just, when you get into it, even on the Wikipedia, and you start talking about quarks and mesons and leptons and all those other kind of things, leprechauns and all the other whatevers, it really is something to behold. And we're getting so sort of understanding of some of these things. Have you heard about quantum computers? I can't get my brain around it, but here's what I'm trying to get at. When you get beyond the small electrons and the protons and neutrons of an atom, you're going to get into the quantum world. And really, the bottom line is the quantum mechanics on the blackboard, now everybody knows there are more than four dimensions: height, width, depth, linear time. And that's really the subject of what this is. And also, too, the UFO thing. People loving their UFOs. Now, anybody who knows really anything about quantum mechanics realizes these are not aliens who have come through space. The distances are too enormous. However, what if these are beings from another dimension? And that's the popular theory now. You can't be transgalactic, so you can be transdimensional. And like we've shared before, I believe that's the enemy priming the pump for when the church is gone and God sends a whopper of a delusion. It wouldn't surprise me if it would be a saucer coming right out of some quantum flux corridor, a wormhole or whatever you might, folding space, and walk right out and land his craft, I don't know, White House lawn. And then he points to some politician. He's your man. We were the ones who built the pyramids. We were the ones that gave you so much of your technology. And we say, he is the man. Follow him. Could go down like that. Back to Mr. Richard Feynman. By the way, Niels Bohr was a Jewish fella. Found that interesting. And so is Richard Feynman. So many of the great breakthroughs in science over the years have come through the Jewish people. Interesting. 1965 Nobel Prize winner for quantum electrodynamics. I think it's safe to say that no one understands quantum mechanics. In fact, it is often stated that all the theories proposed in this century, the silliest is quantum theory. Some say that the only thing that quantum theory has going for it is the fact it is unquestionably correct. That's physicist humor for you, Mike. I hope you enjoyed that. By the way, too, he also worked on the Manhattan Process project. He was a big part of our atomic bomb, et cetera, et cetera. Now, without quantum physics, we would have no lasers. We wouldn't have laser beams. We wouldn't have semiconductors. Are those important? Your phone runs on computer chips and semiconductors. We wouldn't have microcircuits. We wouldn't have cell phones, iPads. The more we know about quantum mechanics, the more we are certain that there are more than four dimensions. So that's day three. Dry land is coming. Life, sea creatures, and plants. Now we're going to get into the next portion of Genesis chapter 1. Well, what is life? Yeah, right. I've got your answer. I bet you didn't know that coming here tonight, you were going to get the answer to the meaning of life. And here it comes. Are you ready to go ahead? This is life. It's a cell. I geek out on stuff like this. When Charles Darwin looked under a microscope and saw a cell, he saw a blob, just a blob, and blobs, because that makes sense, not knowing exactly what was in them, it was easy to then predispose the notion that species could react to their environmental pressures, and we see the differences in the beaks of the finches of the Galapagos Island. Then he said, well, then I'll bet we can go from species to species. And of course, he wrote his book, Origin of the Species. And now evolution, as you know, is the proper take on how everything got here. This cell, the more we know about it, we find out that it is not a blob at all. If we had time, I'd take you around the horn and all this stuff, but more or less, I want you to understand that little guy is packed full of machines. Machines that do things. You've got little trucks in there that take things around. You've got little computer code reading, ribonucleic acid. It's really something. But I want to show you this. Go ahead, if you would. This portion right there, that is the nucleus. Go. Let's zoom in on the nucleus there in the middle. Why is that important? Now you see there the ball in the middle. Let's call that your ball of yarn. That's where your chromosomes are. What's the chromosomes? Go. Look at that ball of yarn. What they are bunches and bunches of chromosomes, all like a ball of yarn, all sort of tied in together. And then let's take them out, if you will. Go and let's lay them out on the page, and there they are. If you're a human being, you get 23 of these. 23 chromosome pairs. And you look at the bottom, go, you have an XY chromosome. Oh, there you go, that's a dude. If you are a man, this is what your 23 chromosomes look like. And they're in every nucleus of your body. So what's a chromosome? Glad you asked. Go ahead. Here is a chromosome. You'll see that this chromosome, in this beautiful illustration here, is actually made up of a super long molecule. You see, you take one of those little threads of your ball of yarn, it's a chromosome. Pull one of those threads, and then the artist has it separated into nucleosomes, and you'll see wrapped around them all is this double helix molecule called DNA. Go. That little circle at the bottom is what we're looking at. This is very important. DNA. Now, when a cell is about to divide, because our cells are multiplying, when a cell is about to divide, pay attention. This is maybe rigorous for some, but I wanted to give you a sense of what's going on here. When a cell is about to divide, this DNA molecule, you'll see, it's got to unzip, starting at that little circle right there. Now remember we said that this molecule is so long in its molecule size, if you could unravel the whole thing, it's 6.5 feet tall at its molecular size. That's how long it is. If the guanine, adenine, cytosine, thymine amino acids were the size of BBs, and that was a rope, an equivalent sort of understanding would be a rope from this pulpit all the way to Carson City, more than 45, 50 miles away. It is hugely important that we get a grip on how this works. All right, so we got to split this chromosome in half. How are we going to do that? Go. It happens in a process called mitosis, and there are four or five major parts. The first part of mitosis is a typical nucleus. There he is. Do-do-do-do-do. See the ball of yarn? Those are all those chromosomes. And then all those chromosomes have all that DNA wrapped up in it. There it is. These chromosomes all wound together. Go. Now we're going to move to the next phase, which is called the prophase. Now things start happening in a hurry there inside of the nucleus. Chromosomes order themselves, and they begin ready to get unzipped. So they go from a ball of yarn to they begin to line up. Well, how did they do that? There's little machines inside the nucleus that move them around. Let's go to that little circle. How do you unzip a DNA molecule? Go ahead. You got to do it like this. And there it is. You see? This is the unzipping of a DNA molecule. I want you to see the little machines that are at work. See in the middle that helicase? That's machine's job is to begin to unzip the molecule in its entirety, right down the middle. And then more machines called enzymes carry free-floating nucleotides. See those little guys kind of hanging loose out there? Those nucleotides, the nucleus, was formulating these nucleotides, and now they're free-flowing right now. But after the helicase separates them, it collects little engines, go grab them, and they put them into a new little machine in there. You see that there? The DNA polymerase. You see that there? And it takes the free-floating pieces of DNA, and like the zipper on your jacket, it puts them back in order, but now there are two. More machines, enzymes, carry free-floating nucleotides, DNA parts, to a machine called a polymerase. You see it there? And that fastens the free nucleotides to their exact proper location on that huge molecule. Now, the nucleus has two exact copies of every DNA molecule, hence two copies of all 23 chromosomes. Now, watch what happens next. Go. All right. So we did our unzipping. Now we got them all lined up. Now we're in something called the metaphase. Two astonishing other little machines called centrioles. Go. There they are. Right there. Those are little tow trucks, and they move to opposite ends of the nucleus. Go, and then what they do is they suddenly grow. Can you see the little cords? Little cords come out of the tow trucks, and they grab those chromosomes, not just anywhere, but right where the X is, called a centrosome, and they attach right there. Go to our next phase, and look what it does. It's called the anaphase, and those little tow trucks with their winches and their ropes pull the two new chromosome pairs away, go, and then they form what the last part of it is. Now you have the telophase phase, and then nuclear membranes begin to form, and you have yourself two cells. That is astounding to me. You have so many machines that unzip the DNA molecule in the first place, and then those little guys, those tow trucks, migrate to the ends of the cell, and then they grow tow ropes, and the ropes happen to find the centrosome, the center of the X, and then they turn on their winches, and they pull the newly copied chromosomes into another ball of yarn, and two cells result. Does that seem pretty astounding to you? It does to me. Really amazing. We saw the metaphase. We saw the anaphase. The ropes bring them over. We saw the telophase, membranes form around the two nuclei, and now the rest of the cell divides. I wanted you to see some of the machines. Did you see them? Did you see the little chucks, the centrioles? Did you see them send out the ropes, and they found the exact center of each chromosome? It turns out that along that DNA cycle, or that DNA ladder, there are 50 gigabytes of information stored in that molecule that is 6.5 feet long. Is that a whole lot of ladder rungs? It sure is. Remember I told you last week, It took us almost 12 years and $2 billion to map 97% of that molecule. And the entire human genome, the DNA molecule, was not completely mapped until 2022. Is that a lot of information? And it turns out that of these many ladder rungs, many are responsible for activating and directing all of those little machines. Turns out that at the metaphase or the prophase, if the cell is not behaving just exactly so, enzymes come coursing in and stop the mitosis process. They turn it on, they turn it off. And it turns out that the rungs in that DNA ladder are the ones that tell all these little machines what to do in the exact right order. And much of cancer research as of late has been trying to find, identify, and understand all of those little digital buttons or rungs. If one of these little buttons doesn't do its job at exactly the right moment, well, you've got a renegade nucleus, and a renegade cell is born. Whew. How often do our cells replicate? I'm glad you asked. Go ahead. Here's our models. There we are. There's Jaden there with her cell phone, and there's some guy. How often do cells multiply? There's your man and your woman. Go ahead. Go. Well, in the typical human and typical man or female, gals, you have 28 trillion cells. And dudes, on average, we are 36 trillion cells. Is that a lot of cells? Skin cells and stomach lining and intestine cells, they've got to be renewed a lot. So you may have an entirely new stomach lining and epidermis. They will renew every 6 to 9 days. What's the largest organ in the body? It's your skin. It's the largest living organ in your body. And the surface, or the epidermis, on average, 6 to 9 days is brand new. Now, there are other cells, like kidney, liver cells. They're not as fast, but you're going to get a brand new kidney and a brand new liver, on average, every 150 to 200 days. Your bone cells, they're renewing. You're going to get a brand new skeleton roughly every 7 to 10 years. Then you have cardiomyocytes, your heart cells. They only regenerate about 1% a year. So you have heart cells that are very old. This is interesting to me. But what about the cells, the neurons in your brain? They are never replaced. I'm sorry, what? You have most of the brain cells you had when you were a kid. I mean, your cranium grows in that respect, but as far as once a neuron is in place, on average, they are not replaced. They don't divide like more other cells do. And does this give us more understanding now? Well, drinking kills brain cells. Yep, that's true. And here's the kicker. Most of those brain cells will never grow back. Just a thought. Drinking and drugs damages those neuron cells, and that damage is irreversible. Well, anyway, for most of our body, however, the cells are dividing. You might get a kick out of this. Go ahead. On average, in your body, 4 million cells are dividing every second. Is that a lot? Go. That's 250 billion cells doing that DNA unzip rezip thing. 250 billion a day for you gals, and 330 billion a day. Here's my point. You're like, easy with all this stuff. I get it. 330 billion for the dudes, 250 billion times a day, your DNA is unzipping and recombining. along a molecule that if end to end stretched out, it would be 6.5 feet tall. 50 billion bytes of information must be copied perfectly 4 million times every second. How perfect does your DNA digital code have to be? Perfect. And does that kind of precision come from a random selection process, which of course is at the core of the logic of evolution? It just, no way. Your DNA self-correcting digital code has to work on average 4 million times a second and 250, 330 billion times a day. What are the odds that every single one of them does it exactly right? Is that something that you fall off the back of a truck with? Or is it something that comes from a perfect designer? Now, of course, some cells don't make the grade, and then your body has other machines that sniff those out and, of course, do away with them, because we don't want wrong cells growing. And another portion of research for cancer is finding out what your body does and how it reacts, recognizes, and deals with those aberrant cells. And then, of course, so many immune problems today is the immune system then can get overcranking and start actually attacking good cells. That's what arthritis is and some of those things. Well, back to our study. So let me sort of kind of put it all together for you. DNA is an error-correcting, self-replicating digital code. It is made up of 3 billion elements which manufacture, rearrange hundreds of thousands of biological devices and machines within the nucleus and the cell. Each machine consists of unique assemblies, lots of parts working together, from over 200 proteins, each protein involving 3,000 atoms in three-dimensional configurations, all defined from an alphabet of 20 amino acids. Hit our go button. This whole thing here, this replicating process, it's a little over my head, but I wanted to show you in its most basic form. Do you see the little machines doing their job? This is one DNA chain being replicated. This is happening 4 million times a second in your body. Would you call that precision? I would. Got a quote for you. Go ahead to the next slide. Chuck Missler, who was trained as an engineer by trade, he says, "There are 77 questions in the final four chapters of the book of Job." God asks Job 77 questions. "Many of these questions man cannot answer even today." Hey, Job, where were you when I did this? Where were you when I hung the stars? Where were you when I did this and that? 77 questions that even humans cannot answer even today. Science claims to be the pursuit of truth, but that is only propaganda. It insists on explanations that exclude the God that has given us that mandate. All of the great founding fathers of science, Newton, Boyle, Pascal, you need to know, they were believers. Did you know that Sir Isaac Newton wrote a commentary on the book of Daniel? Yep, he sure did, in the 1500s. Pascal, who, what a huge mathematician, he was also a born-again believer. He was the one who said, it's like there's a God-shaped hole in the center of anyone who is not a believer, and no other piece like a puzzle fits except the Lord Jesus Christ. That was Blaise Pascal. Well, they pursued their challenges, quote, to the glory of God. However, most of the various fields of study have been taken over by humanists, and Christians, by their indifference, have acquiesced in this satanic takeover, says Chuck Missler, trained as an engineer. Science, which should have been the great testimony to the majesty and the glory of God, has instead become a device for ignoring and rejecting him and preying on the uninformed. What a statement. Chuck Missler used to wear a necklace around his neck, and it was made up of 347 beads. There were some black beads and some white beads, and he wore it for a reason. Hey, Chuck Missler, what's with the puka shells? And why are they arranged in a certain sort of black and white way? Some of them black, some of them white. He said, in binary, on, off, or base two system, they spell out John 3:16. For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son. In binary, or base two system. And then when the people ask him, well, that's dumb, why are you doing that? He said, what would be the probability if I broke the string and let all of the pieces fall to the floor? Scoop them together, run a needle and thread through them, and have my new chain. What are the odds that I would take all those 347 black and white beads just off the floor and it would spell out in binary, for God so loved the world? What are the odds that that would happen randomly with my 347 beads? And people would go, bibbida, bibbida, bibbida. He would say, the probability that these beads would arrange themselves randomly, combined in just the same sequence, is 10 with 104 zeros. Is that a lot? Yeah. Physics says anything with 10 to more than 50 zeros is absurd. In your blood, in your hemoglobin, metalloproofing proteins, it's not a base 2, but a base 574 different amino acids long. That means that there are 10 with 650 zeros possible mutations, but yet they don't mess up. They recombine, and if you were to take all those beads, scatter them across the floor, and they recombine themselves. Is 10,650 zeros of a strong possibility against such random mutation? There have been only 10 to the 18 seconds of all of history. There's only 10 to the 66 atoms in our entire galaxy. All electrons, protons, and neutrons of the whole universe is 10 to the 80. Are you hearing me? He illustrated with the black and white puka shells or beads. He said, the odds of them randomly reformulating themselves and those 650 zeros, here's what he's saying. These beads around my neck took design and a lot of thought to come up with a binary alphabet that spells out, for God so loved the world. DNA is like a jillion times more complex than that. Verse 9, day 3, life. And we'll end pretty much with here. Then God said, let the waters under the heavens be gathered together into one place, and let the dry land appear. Now we know that this is land for sure. And then God said, let there be geologists. Right, Chris? That's what he said. And it was so, verse 10. And God called the dry land earth, and gathering and the gathering together of the waters he called the seas. Now he is separating water horizontally. And God saw that it was good. Verse 11. And then God said, let the earth bring forth grass and herbs that yield seeds, and its fruit trees that yields fruit according to its kind, whose seed is in itself on the earth. Here he is saying speciation. Remember, evolution says you go from one species to another species, and no one has ever done that, not ever, not once. And right here again, God is saying, I made different species of trees even. Verse 12. And the earth brought forth grass and the herb that yields seeds according to its kind, its species, and the tree that yields fruit whose seed is in itself according to its kind, after its own species. And God saw that it was good, verse 13. And so evening, erev, obscurance, muddy, and morning, boker, becoming more discernible, were the third day. Real quickly, and I'll leave you with this. The law of thermodynamics, if you're a physicist or a scientist, you got to know about these. The first two, of course, are most important. First law of thermodynamics, matter is not created or destroyed. We only change its state. Think with me. I created this chair. Well, what I did was I rearranged its branches from wood. Humans have never made a brand new element or any element from nothing. Only God can do that. What about our big atom smashers when we're making new elements? Well, you didn't make it from nothing. You slammed them into each other at such velocities and energy levels, those particles rearranged themselves into berkelium and einsteinium, plutonium and what have you. Humans cannot make matter from nothing. We can't take matter and make it into nothing. Only God can do that. And the second law of thermodynamics is that all energy is winding down, probably since the flood. All fields of science know and work within these solid principles, except one: evolution biology. They're the only ones. Example, let me give you a jar of peanut butter, okay? In an open thermodynamic system, there's some material inside that you can see, peanut butter. Energy can enter and leave the counter through light if it's a clear jar. Evolutionary theory, life can be generated from matter and energy. Is that so? Peanut butter matter happens to be organic matter, not inert. There may be life inside. I get home and unseal it to keep the information out. Why do you pasteurize your milk and your peanut butter and then seal it? You do not want other matter in the form of bacteria to get in there. That's why. The very fact that you seal your peanut butter jar or your milk lets you know that the evolutionary process can happen. Because they say, just give it energy, either light or lightning or what have you, and poof, from inorganic materials come the organic. Not so. There may be life inside, but if you didn't seal it right, because you got bacteria. It's not just matter plus energy. All cells in the universe come from a previous cell. And starting here in Genesis chapter 1, animal cells on day 3. Every cell is millions of systems, machines, interdependent processes, all of which depend on each other to function exactly as planned. Micro mutations do occur, but your body has learned how to develop an immune system to hunt those down and erase them. Components of various cellular machines, I showed you a couple, well, they might change a little bit, but not the entire independent system. In other words, where'd your eyes come from? Well, they evolved. From what? Well, they evolved because the earlier organisms had a sort of a photosensitive group of cells that became an eyeball. Hold on a minute. What is your eyeball made of? A lens. Vitreous humor. Cells on the outside. That is a system that had developed all by itself. Your ear. Well, the ear part is nothing. But when you get into it, you have a tympanic membrane that's hooked to three little bones that then move an inner membrane that changes mechanical energy, wooka, 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 into electronic energy that fires down your auditory nerve. That is a system. The cochlea and all that kind of stuff. In your inner ear, you know you have a cochlea that looks like a big snail cell. And in it, you have hoops that are horizontal, filled with fluid. The fluid has little hairs in it, and the hairs inside the tube, there are little crystals. You have a horizontal cochlea. You have a vertical cochlea. So that if you lean forward, all the little granules rumble to the bottom. And when they do, they tickle little hairs that turn into electronic signals that go to your brain that says, whoa, we're moving forward. That's your balance. And when you come back, all the little hairs tell you we're straight and level. And it also has a 45-degree hoop as well. That is a self, what would be the word? The term I'm looking for. Well, it's balance. That's where you get your balance. And you get car sick because you're moving around the corner and all those little granules are flowing to the side, saying your brain, uh-oh, we're falling over this way. But if you're in an airplane or something that right in front of you, your eyes say, uh-uh, everything's good. But your ears are all, whoa, we're going around a corner. And the confusion of the signals is usually what you see in the form of car sickness or motion sickness. The cochlea itself, how could that become evolved? Hairs, fluid, hoops, horizontal, vertical, and on a 45 degrees, and nerves that attach to those cells. That is not an evolutionary accident. That is design of many systems all at the same time too. Every time you open a sealed food product, you are counting on the fact that the theory of evolution, energy plus matter equals life, aren't you glad pasteurization works? Amen?